Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I hate to disappoint you, Brandon, but I am not a singer and I can't write songs at all. But I love to read them. Oh, it's something I guess we can practice. Well, yesterday we never got to having a look at Lot, even though we had a lot to say about him. So I thought this morning, at least, maybe we should start with Lot, because I really think when you look at how Lot is in the scriptures, we have a song coming.
Just you?
No. Oh. Okay.
Continue.
Okay. Thank you. That was your commercial break for the morning. Yes. I'm sure we can have a lot to say about Brother Jim interrupting the classes, and I'm sure Butch would have a lot to say about that. All right, yes. Technology's great, right? As long as we remember to carry it with us. That's it. Well, it's actually working this morning, too. So, it's not this morning, at least. We'd start a little bit with Lot, have a look at why he's thrown in the scriptures. I think in Genesis there, he's there as a good contrast to, you have Abraham on one hand, and you have Lot on the other. We looked yesterday at how Lot had made the choice to go down there and take the well-watered plain of the Jordan. And you see in chapter 13 at verse 12 that he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. Finally, in verse 14, you see he's moved right next to Sodom, and by chapter 19, he's actually sitting in the gate of Sodom. And you can see there's that progression, is how we make a little compromise here, and then a little more compromise a year later, and before you know it, you're sitting there right in the gate of Sodom. Now, I think probably for most of us, though, if we had just read the story of Genesis, and you were asked to write down your description about what you think God thinks of Lot, I bet most of us would pretty much have written him off. I mean, we'd have no sympathy for what Peter keeps calling that righteous man, whose righteous heart, who's righteous. And God saw him in a totally different light than most of us would see him. That's a warning in terms of how we read people. We don't know what's going on in people's minds. We don't know what's in their hearts. Even though they may make mistake after mistake after mistake and get closer and closer to bad choices, we can't write people off. We can't assume that we know what they're thinking. God does, and fortunately, he makes the choices, not us. He is responsible. When you look back at what originally had happened, though, probably they had a huge group. I mean, you think about what had occurred back in those chapters yesterday. They were arguing over where they could farm their crops and or take their animals. And there wasn't enough room in the land for all of them, for their animals. They quarreled over that. So they decided to separate. You find in chapter 14, at verse 14, Abraham had over 318 trained servants born in his house. Right? And you can see why Abraham would start out when the angel came back to talk to him. And he's talking with the angel. He says, well, what if there's 50 in the city? Well, what about, get down to 40? How about 30? How about 20? 10? There's got to be at least 10. And Abraham probably went away convinced that the angels would find at least 10. And he'd never wake up in the morning seeing smoke rising up out of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, that's what Abraham probably had thought. Lot went down there with a big group of people. And in the end, he pretty much lost them all, just about. You look at it, it's the consequences of his bad choices. See, we don't have to dish out the consequences. That's the great thing about choices in life. When people make bad choices, angels take care of the consequences. We don't have to do that a lot in life. We don't have to get back. We don't have to make sure that they're punished for what they did, or they suffered enough for their mistakes, or that all the young people realize that we made a lot of consequences for them. God brings these consequences. Look at the readings right now we're going through about the life of David. And it's pointed out yesterday that Nathan said that you're going to have wars in your household and all this trouble, and the very next chapter, the angels are already doing it. That's the joy of our God. He takes care of those things for us. We don't have to be the ones that bring out all those great consequences in somebody's life. We don't even know the right ones to bring. But the angels do. They know how to touch people's hearts, and we pray that they will take care of those things. And so look at what Lot's left with. He's got his wife in this case, his two virgin daughters that are down there, two sons-in-law that were probably supposed to marry those daughters. But really, it's too late in Genesis 19. It's too late to influence his family. He's gone and made some bad choices in life, poor choices. But Abraham would have been back there praying for him, praying for Lot. He's not sitting there on the sidelines saying, "Oh, Lot, you made those bad choices. Now you can deal with it. Now you get to live with the consequences." That isn't the spirit of Abraham. He loved him. He loved the household, and he wanted all of them saved. And you can imagine how Abraham would have been praying. In fact, in the end, it's the angels went down there to save Lot because of Abraham. It's a fascinating story. And if you ever look at the angels there as well, and you look at the compassion, and sometimes we read right over these things and we don't even notice them, but you ever notice how compassionate and patient the angels were? The two angels actually went down to Sodom. You know, they went there, they spent the night there. Lot invites them into the house. They took care of the safety of Lot. They waited all night. The angels, with all their authority and power, waited all night for Lot to get everybody he could to gather with him and take them out of Sodom. And in the morning, when Lot and his family delayed, the angels, it says, the Lord being merciful, they grabbed them by the hands and they led them out of Sodom. I mean, this is the family we've been called to, brothers and sisters. People who love, they show compassion, kindness, mercy. This is what the angels are there in the record for. They're there to show us this is how God's family members behave. And this is where we practice, here at Bible school, back in our ecclesias, in our families. That's our time to practice righteousness. So due to his poor choices, Lot certainly had to live with this. You know, you could see how very easily, you know, you could lead into depression. I think in Genesis 19 at verse 29, it's a great thing to underline and realize that when it came to pass that when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. Oh, that's why we pray for our families. We never give up. The prayers of a righteous man have great power and their effects, James says. And Abraham had been praying after that angel talked with him, you know, and he realized that this is the time. Abraham probably prayed all night that God would be merciful to Lot and his family and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. He overthrew all the other cities. That's what you find about Bible characters. They're constantly praying for their families. Now, when you look at what happens in ecclesial life, when we don't welcome people and make it very comfortable for them to come back when they've made bad choices, the natural tendency is for them to walk away. And I think this story is there for us to realize as ecclesial elders and as people who operate in ecclesias and we're working with people, that the natural tendency when folks have made bad choices, when our young people make bad choices at times and get involved with things they shouldn't do, it's so easy to judge them and put up this wall of we don't really welcome them. We're not really sure we want them here. And because of the mistakes that they have made. Or we want to make sure they pay for it and everybody realizes that we didn't approve of that mistake. Well, I don't think Abraham was like that. I think Abraham would have had a welcoming spirit like the father of the prodigal son. And even with that, Lot found it difficult to walk back to Abraham. That's how hard it is for people to come back. It is tough. You talk to people that have left the truth for a while and they're interested in coming back out to meeting, and they tell you about the fears that they face. They don't know how to face everyone. They don't know what everybody's going to think about them. They don't know how to walk back through the door because of the fear that's in them of trying to come back to our ecclesias. Sometimes because of how we make them feel. This is the aurora that we put out there. This is how we've made them feel sometimes because of mistakes that they've made. So you look back at this story and you figure, well, what Lot should have done, what he should have done was gone back to Abraham's household. There wasn't any problem anymore about the herdsmen arguing about room for the flocks. That's all over. He should have gone back, and he still found it difficult to walk back to Abraham. His bad choices had really made it very ineffective for him to do it. You look back at in the story in Ruth. Remember, it was revealed how difficult it was for Naomi to walk back into the community. And then she just comes back and just call me Mara, you know, because of things that have happened. It was so hard to come back. And we have to welcome people. We have to, you know, put out the arms of the prodigal son's father and welcome them. Hug them when they come back. Make them realize they're welcome or so glad to see them. That's what ecclesias are supposed to be for. You make it easy for people to come back. But what does Lot do? He chooses to go hide in a cave. I really think in this story you're seeing an example of a very depressed ecclesial member. He's a depressed Christadelphian, made bad choices. His family's suffering. He's gone through all that he has. You know, he ends up making one bad choice after another. And look at what depression does to people. It drives them away. And we have to search them out and bring them back. Because one bad choice will lead to another and another. And because he wouldn't go back to Abraham, and he goes up into the caves, his daughters look around and say, well, what's the hope of this family? And they end up going through the process of getting their dad drunk and fathering children. He ends up being the father of their children. And I really think that what you'll see in Genesis, which is interesting to me, is that alcohol comes up in the stories in Genesis a number of times. And there's great warnings about the effects of alcohol. I think that's good for all of us in our community to realize, for our young people, for everybody, that this is not the answer. This is what people of this world do. They turn to alcohol and just go through that and figure this is going to solve their problems. You look back in Genesis 9, we didn't have time to look at Noah back then, but this is what had happened. Noah had become drunk and Ham came into the tent. In Genesis 9, back at verse 21, too much to drink. In Genesis 19, Lot's daughters realized they had seen by experience that, hey, this is no problem. You just get dad drunk and he won't even know what he does. You find out later on in Genesis 20:29, I'm really sure that a lot of us have wondered, like, how in the world did Jacob not know that he went into Leah instead of Rachel? But that's what happens when you drink too much. And it's a good warning to all of us, brethren and sisters and young people, that God holds us accountable for choices that we make when we get drunk. This world may not. This world may say, oh, you have a disease. Or, you know, you were just drunk and you didn't know what you were doing. But God holds us accountable for the consequences when we get drunk. And we have to then live with that because God deals with those things and figures that we're going to have to now live with what we have done. It's a good warning to all of us in terms of that. So you look at Lot's bad choices. He lost his wife, most of his household. He lost his home and all his possessions. The sad thing is he lost touch with Abraham. That's really sad and didn't feel comfortable coming back to the ecclesia of the time. And what people tend to do in those situations is to become depressed, as Lot did. They want isolation from the group because they don't want to stand for the judgment of the group. And he ends up impregnating his two daughters at this point. Terrible choices. So it's tough to make good choices in the midst of the bad ones. We've got to learn to overcome our embarrassment and our pride. Come back like the prodigal son did. That's hard. And I think from the ecclesia's responsibility, we have to make it easy, as easy as we can, for people to make that choice. Because it is so difficult for them to do it. We may need to pull out of depression at that point. And it's going to take some encouragement from other people. Because we can get really discouraged and despair from all the bad choices we've made. We have brothers and sisters who have made bad choices in our community. When you talk to them now after years, they feel that the community feels, and they themselves feel, that they've made choices that were so bad that they can never come back. They feel that way. Talk to them. This is how people feel. And this is what they're going through. They're like children that need help. They need parents that will give them good counsel. They need brothers and sisters who love them, who will talk to them, invite them to their homes, and go to a meeting with them. Take them out to an event and go with them. Pick them up and take them. That's what we need. So what we need to learn to do is talk to God in prayer. Our Father in heaven is not like that. He's always got his arms open. He views life as a series of experiences for us where we make mistake after mistake after mistake, and he's willing to constantly, always work with us. That's the amazing part of our God. He's always willing to do that. You look in the stories in Jeremiah that we're doing in the readings right now, as often as God said, this is it for the people, this is it, I'm going to destroy, don't pray for these people, Jeremiah, you still see times in these chapters in Jeremiah where God will say, well, if you do change your minds and you turn around, then you're welcome back, and I will bless you, and I will take care of you, because that's the way our God is. He's willing to let us learn from those mistakes, only hoping that we will turn back to him. So, on to Isaac. All right, Isaac. Isaac had a tough beginning. You look at Isaac's life growing up. Some of you may look back at a life like this. Did you ever grow up in a family where you got bullied by your older brothers or sisters? Some of you here probably did, where you have older brothers and they just like bully you, or maybe you lived in a community, in a neighborhood where people bullied you all the time. Well, that's the life of Isaac. He grew up being bullied by Ishmael. You find out in Genesis 21 that as Isaac grew, because at this point in time, although Sarah had sent Hagar away, Hagar came back, and now Ishmael's there. Ishmael's probably 14 years older. Imagine having a 14-year-old brother who's there to do what he wants with you. So as the child grew and was weaned, Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. And therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son Isaac, with my son, namely Isaac. Now, you can imagine how in the Christadelphian community, I've watched at times where we're doing the Bible readings and people just say, well, what do you think about this story? What do you think about Sarah? What do you think about this? And it's all about, what do you think? And people come with all kinds of ideas about how bad Sarah was and how wicked she was and how badly she mistreated Hagar and all of this. And that may be what you tend to think reading the story. And again, I'm fascinated by New Testament exposition, because so often the New Testament sets us straight on what's actually happening here in the Old Testament. And when you go back and look at this, Sarah understood what the angel had said. That you, Sarah, will have a son. Abraham, this will be your child, and this will be the child of promise. Sarah got it. Abraham didn't. That was Abraham's problem. Abraham loved Ishmael. What father wouldn't? He'd raised him for 14 years. He took him to meeting. He took him to Sunday school. He brought him to CYC. He took him to the Bible camps. He took him everywhere. They did the whole thing. And God in the end says, take your son, your only son, Isaac. Ooh, that would be hard. And Abraham pleads with God, oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight. God says, no, that's not how it's going to be, Abraham. Those are tough, tough family choices, brethren and sisters. Those are hard. I mean, most of us tend to think that if we go through the program and we raise our children and we do the Bible readings at home and we go to Sunday school and the Bible class and the Bible camps and we send them to the youth conferences, there's a program laid out and it's just, they're all going to follow in the pathway and God will love them and accept them into his family. And Abraham did that with this son. And God says, no, it's going to be Isaac. Isaac will be your only son. Ooh, that would have been tough for Abraham. When you look back at the persecution that Isaac went through, a lot of us tend to think, well, the standard thing today is for the kids to grow up. I used to hear this at school all the time as a teacher. They'd come in and tell me how their day went yesterday and how they got bullied at school or somebody mistreated them this way. And they'd always come out with the line, that's not fair. It's not fair what I'm going through. And you can imagine how, you know, Isaac would have felt the same way. It's not fair. But really, what God does, if you have the faith of Abraham, the faith of Jesus Christ, you accept whatever God brings into your life and you make the most of it. It's not a case of fairness. It's not a case of whether this is, you know, what somebody else got and I'm getting something different. We don't look at it that way. We look at whatever happens in our life, whatever happens, the good and the bad, that God has a reason. God's on all of this stuff, as Paul says in Romans 8, in dealing with the family, you know, that in everything God works for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. In everything. So it doesn't matter how you got treated as a child. It doesn't matter what your parents did to you or what your siblings did or how what family you grew up in compared to somebody else. God is working in everything, and he's doing it to bring about good. So when we do have persecution, when things don't go our way, when we have a spouse maybe who doesn't treat us properly like other spouses maybe do, and we look around in the ecclesia and we start thinking, well, I wish I had that one, that's what can happen in life. Instead of realizing that, wait a minute, maybe this is what I need. Maybe God's put me in this situation because I need this. I'm going to learn from this. And he's training me. And as Paul says, for the moment, none of this is great, doesn't feel good, but later it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those that have been trained by it. This is what it does. It forces us to consider what's really important in life, what really matters. And it teaches us to rely on God, not on ourselves. And this is what develops faith. This is the kind of faith God is looking for, that we trust God, he knows what he's doing, and he will get us through this. Now, that's what got Job through his situations. This is what got Jesus Christ through what he went through. That kind of faith. And we know that in all these things, God is working for good. Hebrews 12, I love that passage because Paul says, you know, that afterwards, Paul is so reasonable, he acknowledges that he doesn't just say, well, just count it all joy and just laugh and be happy when you run into various trials, as James would. And it's true, if you have that long-term prospect, you can. But Paul's at least honest and says, well, no chastening for the moment seems joyful, but it's painful. He's honest. But later it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Do you notice how Paul deals with God's chastening there? I think as parents and grandparents, we should at least look for a second at the concept that he talks about being chastened by the Lord. He doesn't say punished. You ever notice that in the scriptures? As grandparents and as parents raising our children, our unfortunate thing today is our English versions in the Old Testament many times have taken a Hebrew word, which means instruction, and they've translated it punishment. That's sad because they misunderstand what God's doing with his children. There is a Hebrew word for punishment and a Greek word, and then the wicked will be punished by God. God doesn't punish us. A lot of us never even look at that. We don't even realize this is how he treats us. He doesn't punish his children. He instructs us. He chastens us. He disciplines us for our good. And that's the model that we should have as parents. This is how we raise our children. We don't ever use the word punish. I'm punishing you. We use the biblical terms that we're instructing, we're teaching, we're training. That's how Paul saw it. God's a coach. He's training us. He's not putting us through punishment. And we shouldn't do that as parents and grandparents either, or as arranging brethren. Oh, isn't that interesting? We don't punish people for their mistakes. We're not in that position. We instruct, we train. Everything we bring into someone else's life, all those consequences, are to train and to instruct and to teach. That's what they're supposed to be for, not to punish. It's an interesting study sometime. You go through the Old Testament, you look at those words that are used for punishment, and God's talking about his children. The Hebrew word there just means instruction. He's training us. As Paul got it. He understood how it works. He's training us to join his family forever. So you look at how Abraham and Sarah had worked together with this issue of Isaac and Ishmael. Sarah wants Hagar and Ishmael out this time. She wants them out permanently because they've got to go. This is not the promised seed. Abraham's all distressed. Oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight, God. He doesn't want to do this. And so God assures Abraham, this is okay. I'm going to work with Isaac. He is the chosen seed. And so Abraham does what Sarah wants. You ever notice that? He divorces Hagar and disowns his son. This is not just legal separation. This is a total separation from Hagar. She's gone now. She's been divorced out of the family. Ishmael's been disowned. He's not even his child anymore. She's gone to go do whatever you want, but you're not going to be part of the family of God. God's made a choice. And you might think that's tough for Sarah to do that, but when the Apostle Paul gives his New Testament commentary on this story, This is what I love about Paul, is that he tells us the right way to read these Old Testament stories. So when he talks about the allegory with Hagar and with Sarah, the Jerusalem is above with Sarah and the Jerusalem below, which is Judaism and all of its stuff with Hagarism and slavery, he says that we brethren in Galatians 4, verse 28, we brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he was born according to the flesh, then persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, even so it is now. Because the Jews of the day were persecuting the believers, and they were reliving this persecution that they would say, that's not fair, but they were reliving the persecution that Isaac went through. Nevertheless, what does Sarah say? No. Not what does Sarah say. What does the scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. See, there's the New Testament support for how you read the Old Testament story. It's not about what do I think. It's about what does God think. And he tells us when we look around the scriptures. That's the benefit of reading the new and the old and combining them together. You learn so much about these Old Testament stories. And in this case, Sarah was right. So we move on in Isaac's life. You move on to Genesis 22. Can't pass by that one. You look at the obedience that's there. I really think that's part of what you learn from Isaac, is you learn from the story of Isaac, obedience in the midst of persecution. You still obey. Even though things were going wrong, even though you were mistreated, all those things happened to you early in life, those are not excuses for mistakes that we make later on. We can still obey our God, regardless of the past. And so Abraham gets challenged as well, and so does Isaac here. This whole lesson of faith leading to obedience. That if you have the faith, if we really do have faith, then no matter what God brings into our life, we will obey. Now we'll make some mistakes along the way, but the basic thing is we will practice obedience, practice righteousness. And so Abraham rises in the morning, not understanding what God's doing, doesn't understand what God's putting him through. I really think what God wanted to do was not so much test obedience as to help Abraham understand what it was going to cost God to save the race. Never looked at it from God's perspective. He's trying to help Abraham understand that here's what it's going to cost me. And he lets Abraham work through this for 3 days of mentally thinking about killing his son, what this is going to be like. And in the end, when he saves him out of it, Abraham totally understood the emotional side of what it would cost God to save the race. This is what our God was willing to go through. And that story, it's there to help us understand that same thing. Obedience, but certainly leading that great lesson. Obedience to parents. When you start looking at God's plan, when we raise our children as parents and we teach obedience, it's important to teach obedience. If our children don't learn to obey us, they will never slide into the role of learning to obey God. This is what God's hoping for. We raise our children when they're young, and we teach them about obeying your parents. As Paul says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. He quotes, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, right? That it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And so we teach our children that, and we teach them that. And as they grow up through those years, we don't just force it on them as, you know, the kind of like, you know, the rigid requirement of law. But what we try to do as parents is get our children to realize why we are asking for obedience, what the big picture is, so that they will obey us because they love us as parents, not because we said this is what you have to do. Well, that's a huge transition to make with your teenagers, isn't it? To get them to where they obey because they love you, not because they have to. And this is the transition God is hoping all of us go through in our spiritual life. We may start out obeying God because of fear of punishment or something like that, and that's the way we begin. We think God's going to get us. We don't want to stand before the judgment seat and be rejected. But what God hopes for is that we will progress, and perfect love will cast out fear. That's not some theoretical, you know, idea, analytical thing that John just throws out. It's a real concept you can aim for, to where you love God. You have a relationship with Jesus Christ to the point that we are obedient because we love, not because we fear. Fear is not a greatest, it's not a good enough motivation to ever get us to the kingdom. We're not going to get there by just fearing. That isn't going to do it. Because love, we know the scriptures, that love has more power. That was the difference between following the law of Moses versus understanding what it was designed to teach. To love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. That's what God was after. Because love has power. And fear has to do with punishment. And that's not what's going to drive us to the kingdom. It has to be based on love. And so that's what you see here, that you have obedience coming in, obedience to parents. You'll see that later on in Samuel when it comes up in 1 Samuel 15 when Saul's all worried about, you know, following the laws, right? Got to do the sacrifice. Samuel says, "Has not the Lord great delight in burnt offerings, as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. And to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness as iniquity and idolatry. And because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king." Obedience is a key item. This is what God is looking for. He's looking for faith that leads to obedience. That's what he wants. Not law that leads to obedience, because by works of law, no flesh will ever be justified, including Jesus Christ. That isn't what does it. It's faith that leads to obedience, based on, motivated by love. This is what we're after, brothers and sisters. This is what God wants in his family members. He does expect obedience. We know that from the scriptures. We could pile up passages where God says to obey. Obey God rather than men in Acts 5. And in Romans 6, Paul talks about how we now are freed from being slaves of sin, but we have become slaves of righteousness. You know, we're still under that slavery. And in Hebrews 5 and verse 9, how he brought salvation to all who obey him. Right? We find in Hebrews 3 that the warning was there about those who did not obey. They didn't have the faith, Paul says, and because they lacked the faith, they never could enter in the land. So this is what God is really after, is a faith that leads to obedience. You look in Jeremiah, in the early chapters in Jeremiah that we read just recently, but did you notice how in Jeremiah 7, when he's chewing out the people and talking about the failures of the people and what they did wrong, and how you go up to Shiloh and look up there, all of you who want your law, go up to Shiloh and look at what's left up there. Probably in the days of Saul, when the Philistines came up along the coast, they went through the land, they came down through the central part of the land and they battled with Saul, they wiped out Shiloh and there was nothing left. God just wiped it out. So go up there and see what your law is going to get you. I didn't want legalism and obedience to law. In verse 21 of Jeremiah 7, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Go ahead and add burnt offerings to your other sacrifices and eat the meat yourselves. For when I brought your forefathers out of Egypt and spoke to them, I did not just give them commands about burnt offerings and sacrifices, but I gave them this command. Exodus 19, you go back and look. When he brought the community to the Mount Sinai, and he thundered in lightning, and he talked to them the Ten Commandments, what did he say? Obey me, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. That's what he wanted, was obedience. And then he gave them the law to help them learn obedience. Obedience based on faith, though, not based on law. But that's what he did. Walk in all my ways, I command you, that it may go well with you. But they did not listen or pay attention. Instead, they followed the stubborn inclinations of their evil hearts. That's what happened. So in Hebrews 12, when the Apostle Paul's laid out all these people who by faith, they endured to the end. That's what they did. In his compiled list, that's what he brings up. People who had their faith. When it talks about these all died in faith, it's really, the NIV has there, what the Greek really has, it's these died still having their faith. It's not just these all died in faith. No, it's these died still maintaining their faith. They had it to the end. Because that's Hebrews 10, 11, 12. He's talking about endurance to the end. That's what he's after. So since we have this huge cloud of witnesses around us, let us lay aside every embrace and the sin which so easily encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of faith. If you've got our faith in there, you see, you missed the point. The translators of Bibles were a lot of times Christian people who believed in the Trinity. They didn't understand that Jesus Christ was saved by faith. They didn't get it. That's one of the great things John Thomas came along and understood, that Christ was saved by faith. That God all along had saved everyone by faith. That was always the plan. Faith that leads to obedience. So they had to put in the words, our faith, because they couldn't understand how Jesus Christ could have faith. But Paul knew it. He lists Jesus after going through all of Hebrews 11. In chapter 12, he then says, here's the greatest example of faith. He's the author and perfecter of faith. Because for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despised the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary. Think about what Jesus Christ went through for us. I mentioned the other day that the Apostle Paul, in writing to the Romans, in the beginning of his treatise and at the end, in two places, again though, it's a misunderstanding of the translators. A lot of them don't understand what he's getting at. But you look at how in chapter 1 of Romans, when he talks about Jesus Christ, he's going to give the exposition of the salvation by faith in Jesus Christ. That he talks about in verse 5, that through him, that's through Jesus, we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles for his name's sake. It's not obedience to the faith, like the faith was the Christadelphian BASF or something, and it's obedience to the faith. It's the obedience of faith, faith that leads there. And if you missed it in chapter 1, you don't miss it when he gets to the end of the letter. In the last few verses in Romans 16, he ends on the same note when he talks about to him in verse 25, who's able to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery which has been kept secret for ages long past, but now is manifested, and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the eternal God, has been made known to all the nations, leading to obedience of faith. This Paul caught, he got it. He had tried obedience to the law for his whole life, and all it had done is lead him down a pathway that was leading to death. And Jesus saved him out of this. He enlightened Paul to understand what the obedience of faith was really all about. Faith that leads to obedience, for which we can accept and have by God's grace, the grace of God. This is what motivates us. Just to show you how our translators really don't get it at all. In Romans chapter 3, when he talks about the righteousness of God, after going through the Gentiles' failure in chapter 1 and the Jewish failure of chapter 2, and then God providing the mystery of providing Jesus Christ, in chapter 3, he says in verse 26, to declare, I say at this time, his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. And we read through that and we think, well, that's fine, right? But then when you get and look in the Greek, it's not actually which believeth in Jesus. The Greek is, as the NASB has in their margin, him who is of the faith of Jesus. See, Paul then says what God has done is he's provided up on the cross the example of faith for all. Here's the way back to the Father. You live by faith, obedience leading to faith. And God can forgive the mistakes along the way because you're aiming at obedience by trusting in God. And so this is the faith of Jesus. And God can be just and the justifier of all of us who have the faith of Jesus. That's what he really says in Romans chapter 3. And to show you how they miss it, Paul goes on and gives the example in chapter 4 of Romans of Abraham. And he talks about Abraham being such a great example, father of the faithful. And Abraham, when was he justified? Was it before he was circumcised or after he was circumcised? It was before, right? He was saved by faith, justified by faith. And he talks about he's the father of the circumcision in verse 12, those who are not only of the circumcision, but also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while he was uncircumcised. And he goes on in verse 16, therefore it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise, look at those words, grace, faith, promise. This is what Abraham's living out right now in this story with Isaac. So that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Now you see how they put in your version there, who is of the faith of Abraham? If you look in the Greek text, you'll find that's exactly the same as Romans chapter 3. But they don't understand that you can have the faith of Jesus. They can understand you can have the faith of Abraham, but how can you have the faith of Jesus? He's a God, you know, and that's how they view him. But this is what Paul wants us to understand. This is what saved Jesus Christ. This is what saves all of the family, is we develop the faith of Jesus Christ, the faith that Abraham had. We walk in the steps of that faith leading to obedience. This is how it works, brethren and sisters. It's not by law of fear and punishment of what you're going to get. It's by this positive reinforcement of a loving God who's been willing to give his son, and he cares, he loves us, and look at what he's done for us. And he's trying to invoke a response from us because he loves us to the point that he was willing to give his son. And his son was willing to live a life of putting up with all that he endured, trusting his dad to save him day after day. That's the example that's been left on record. That is what the cross represents to us, is a man who crucified sin, trusting in his father, who had the faith to put sin to death. That's what he did. And this is the faith that leads to obedience, that will allow the grace of God to forgive all of our mistakes. Because without faith, it's impossible to please him. He who comes to God must believe. That word in the Greek is faith. We must be faithing all the time that he is, and he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And this is what will motivate us to do God's will. Faith has power to change the way we live. It really does. It changes how we live. In fact, that faith that has power, the reason it has such power, brethren and sisters, is because we grow up in a world today where we sometimes think, well, faith in God, this is tough to have faith. Faith is some concept that's out there that we don't even understand or we really can't get. But when you think about it, you practice faith all the time in your life. You're always exhibiting faith in things and stuff. Faith in watches, that we have the right time, we've got a minute left or whatever. We have faith that it's keeping the right time. We have faith in our cell phones. We have faith in our technology. When you get in a car and you start that car, you've got a lot of faith when you turn that key, it's going to start up. And when you get to an intersection and cars are coming by and your foot's on that pedal and you're ready to go, all of us have faith that when that opening, that little opening's there and we push that pedal down, you believe your car's not going to just go put out into the center and get run over. You believe that it's going to go into that traffic and you're going to be able to accelerate. When it comes time to stopping at a red light, you believe when you put your foot on the brake, it's going to stop. See, these are not tough concepts. We live through them every day. We practice them all the time. But to believe that angels are here right now, that they're taking care of us, that they've designed what we're going through, to believe that God really will take care of us, to believe that the unseen is working in our life, that's the tough part. Faith is not a hard concept. We practice it all the time. But faith in God, which leads to obedience, that one is tough. That's where it becomes hard for us. Well, I was going to look at a wife for Isaac today, but I guess we just aren't going to get there. For those of you that want to look through Isaac's life and look at like some of the things that are there, I think as parents and grandparents that you get a lot of counsel from Abraham and Isaac of what Abraham went through to find a wife for Isaac. And maybe tomorrow we'll get a chance to have a look at some of those things, but I don't think so today. But anyways, from Abraham and Sarah, we will jump ahead. And as you can see, because I threw in Lot, we're just not going to get there. But some of the lessons that you can get, at least from Isaac and Rebecca today, is persecutions can have a good impact in our life. If you feel sometimes like the ecclesia persecutes you, or your spouse does, or your children do, whatever you feel, don't write it off as just saying, that's not fair. Try to learn from it and realize this can have a good impact of driving us to God, talking to Him in prayer, looking for God's response. God wants obedience. He wants obedience to Him, not ritualistic behavior to law. That is so hard for all of us. It was hard for the Jews. We look at them and we write them off and say today, well, they were crazy and they followed all their law. And then what do as Christadelphians? We go right back and have our own little laws that we do. We obey to our laws. What God's after is obedience to His laws. His laws, not just the laws that we come up with today. Obedience to parents, it is a great opportunity to practice obedience to God. So those of you that are younger, still living in families underneath your parents' control and those rules that they have, that's okay. That's good practice for learning to be obedient to our God later on. And parents, I think, yeah, we do need to get our kids out to activities. It is important that we find people for them to be with and to be around. And that's a responsibility we all have. And we'll leave it at that for today, and we will hopefully pick up maybe a little bit of Isaac tomorrow, maybe, and definitely move into Jacob tomorrow. Thank you, God willing.